Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. My grandnephew, William Copeland IV, will be 1 year old this Sunday, October 9th. And Henry Caskell, known as Smokey, died last week. He was my sister's longtime friend and neighbor. He and I were in Vietnam 50 years ago as Marines in mostly the same places up near the DMZ, and although we had not known each other until my economic exile from Astoria nearly 2 years ago, we probably crisscrossed each other in our various search and destroys that ultimately incinerated at least two-thirds of South Vietnam's villages by the end of the war. Coincidentally, Hanoi Hannah has also died at age 87. Her name was Trinh Thi Noh. She is rightly considered a national treasure of her country's liberation from Caucasoid domination. The day before a troop shipload of U.S. Marines that included me landed, peacefully, at Chu Lai half a century ago, she welcomed us on her radio broadcast and warned that our presence was a dangerous refutation of our own liberation history. And she might have singled us out because the Navy scow we were aboard, a former Caribbean banana boat sequestered for World War II troop ship duty, was named for a principal signer of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, USS George Clymer, which was known throughout the Navy as the Greasy George because of an oily bathtub ring it left in the ocean. I don't know if any of you listening today might remember my broadcast just after this past summer's Democratic convention of a political satire I concocted 20 years ago for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle. The theme was Bill Clinton and Bob Dole visiting Astoria's truly mythical Top of the Astor nightclub and cafe during the presidential campaign of 1966 and working out a deal to confound the Constitution, the transmutation of Billy Bob. I mentioned I might dredge a few more out of the cryptic files this political season and insinuate a few comparisons and similarities from the final presidential campaign of the last millennium. The one I am going to rehash today is from late 1995 and is about Newt Gingrich, who has been something of a precursor to Donald Trump, like a spacey John the Baptist, you might say. It would almost seem as if Newt has finally relinquished his lopsided odyssey for the American presidency. Would there be any other reason for his amorous cheerleading for the ultimate pretender, Donald Trump? Perhaps he imagined his last hope might be through the back door as Trump's vice president, but he was trumped and out-pensed. Newt has had a long love affair with his ambition to be president. His campaigns have been gaudy failures. And unlike his serial marital life, he has remained faithful to his superego. So now, return with me to those thrilling days of yesteryear and Alt Astoria's world-famous icon for sensuous and liquid pleasure, the Top of the Astor. And, FYI, most of the quotes attributed to Newt are from his own mouth. The rest of this muckraking parody is my responsibility, and so the usual disclaimer is operational. I call it Newt's Here. I am standing at my usual place at the bar of Astoria's premier night spot, the Top of the Astor, overdosing my liver with an inexpensive poison I call Red Death, when this pompous guy with uptight silver hair walks in with three very predatory-looking persons. He leads them to a table in a corner next to windows that look out over the city's waterfront and the Columbia River, which stretches 4 miles to the Washington shore. I see clouds outside the windows rise out of the ocean and spread across the sky like a sheet pulled over a corpse. My friend Rio Rita takes their orders. "You know who those people are?" I ask her when she comes to the bar. She looks at me wearily. "Yeah, I know who they are," she says. "Buttheads and Beavis." "Newt Gingrich and three stooges from Salem," I say. "Clairno, Durfler, and Tiernan, the new breed of Wild West suburban Republicans. Tom McCall would despise them." Rita looks over the table. "Like I said," she says, Beavis and Buttheads. She loads drinks on a tray and takes them to Newt's table. I slide down the bar so I can listen. I am curious why Newt Gingrich, the most powerful speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives since Uncle Joe Cannon's grim and reactionary reign during the first Roosevelt, is in Astoria, far away from Beltway celebrity and mainstream media. I am quickly answered. Newt jabbers while Clairneau, Derfler, and Tiernan lean eagerly toward him like a football huddle. He is ecstatic that the Oregon legislature has successfully fabricated what he says is a contract with Oregon, quote unquote, which he says over and over again like a mantra. Newt praises the reinvention of private property and the hoped-for demolition of Oregon's once pioneering land use laws. He is a cheerleader for clear-cutting the last public forests and abolishing endangered species laws. The same for clean air and pure water regulations, which interfere with the economics of pollution and sewage. Newt raises Rita's thermostat when he greets the obsequious top of the Astor manager with boisterous support for applying waitress and waiter tips to any pay raise, an idea cooked up by the state's restaurant owners. I don't get paid anything because my tips are taxed more than I get, Rita gripes to me. Now Newt and my boss want the tips I don't get to be the raise they're never going to give me. Newt looks at Rita like she doesn't exist when she goes back to the table. She returns to the bar with an empty tray, stiffed. They're treating me like a bathhouse slave, Rita says. Of course they are, I say. They are demonstrating their superiority over you after reducing you to poverty. She looks at me sourly. You don't get it, she says. These are bite your mother's nurturing breast kind of people. It's got nothing to do with politics. Everything's got to do with politics, I retort. Rita shakes her head. Their whole way of looking at life is because they don't think they got enough nipple when they were babies, she says. Newt congratulates the three Oregon legislators for their loyalty to the Republican banner throughout the 1995 session of the state legislature, which the GOP, for the first time in 40 years, packed both houses. He likens it to the Republican-dominated 104th Congress's breakneck and breakheads tempo, its first 100 days to pass his ambitious and hard-hearted contract with America, which critics parallel to a mafia contract. Newt praises Tiernan's merciless attack on public workers and Derfler's aggressive efforts to peel back Oregon's vanguard land use laws. He is more restrained and less specific when he tepidly compliments Clairneau, a woman, for upholding the contract with Oregon in her status as Speaker of the State House of Representatives. A contract with Oregon is a contract with America, Newt says grandly. And vice versa, Tiernan interrupts excitedly. Newt implores his passionately avaricious toadies to carry the contract's banner beyond the legislative session. You can't go home and rest on your laurels, he tells them. The contract must be implemented everywhere, carried to every farm and suburb. We must reassert American civilization because we have to lead the human race, Newt says. We need a new American journey. We need a quest into the future. I stare at Newt's reflection in a large mirror back of the bar. I can't focus on him. He is jerky and irrepressible, a distinct type of American character, both appealing and repellent, an ideologue graced with a little learning and the power to use it. His speech is larded with hyperbole and space babble. Jerry Brown of the right, some call him, only farther out in space. Neuter Moonbeam. Andy Rooney, plated over Space Rangers. Boris Yeltsin, Southern Fried. People who know him say Newt is concerned about humanity, but has a hard time relating to human beings, which they really mean he is a control freak. He promotes himself as vigorously as if he is a car or a house he is marketing. Government must be returned to the people, Newt says, to you state legislators, to mayors and city councils. That's what the contract with Oregon means. Power to the people, Clairneau, Derfler, and Tiernan say in unison, almost as an amen. The government is out of control and out of date, Newt says. It's obsolete and backward thinking and needs dynamic change. Our modern leaders have forgotten that government cannot substitute for private initiative, personal responsibility, or faith. Newt says the country needs a new modern dialogue, an American people's plan, and a new birth of American freedom, both of which sound like 12-step programs. Newt blames welfare for America's malaise. He says welfare fosters anti-work, anti-family, and anti-property. We must replace the welfare state with the opportunity society and the world market state, he says. Newt blows bromides like bubbles. Work over laziness, he says. Savings over debt. Family over individual chaos. He says the Democratic Party despises the values of the American people and indulges in multicultural hedonism that is inherently destructive of a healthy society. Republicans are the real Americans, Newt says, the normal Americans. We are the party of Main Street, not Wall Street, he says disingenuously and rather unbelievably. There may be a Republican epic, but it is not a romantic myth, he rhapsodizes. It's more about people coming together on a wagon train and how hard it was going west. At the end of this period, people will say, I was on the wagon train that dramatically changed the country. I almost knock over my glass of Red Death, my name for a favorite cheap red wine, at Newt's blather, but the new Oregon pioneers stare at him in rapture. We are the new revolutionaries, Newt says. We aren't going to replace the social engineering of the left with social engineering of the right. That's absolute nonsense. A new civilization is emerging in our lives, and blind men everywhere are trying to suppress it. Clairno, Derfler, and Tiernan nod and look serious. The enemies of democracy are within its body like a cancer. That's what Jefferson said, Newt says. Cancer and calumny eat away at democracy from within. Sounds more like Joe McCarthy. Anybody can use Jefferson, which Newt does, again, almost immediately. When Jefferson said every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos, Newt says. He was making an argument for the creative replacement of the old order for a new order. If all you are is a revolutionary with no sense of order, all you are is a bandit. But Newt twists Jefferson. Old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. Newt's purpose is to return America to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder. Newt's America runs especially counter to Thomas Paine's America, which is a vision of a decent and happy life for ordinary people who are rulers rather than ruled. Newt wants to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property, which currently dominates but does not yet entirely rule the country. Politics means allowing somebody to dominate your life, Newt says, reversing Jefferson and Paine, as well as a majority of previous founders and assorted same-period revolutionaries. I think of Juvenal, writing of old Rome's political gangs. Yesterday they were ruffians. Today they rule over our lives. Tomorrow they will be keepers of the lavatories. In old Rome, Newt would have been leader of a political street gang that beat opponents to death and burned their houses down. He torches our national house and acts like the Caesar of its reconstruction. I wonder if Newt regards himself as F. Scott Fitzgerald's model of a first-rate intellect, who is able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. More likely, his zealously superficial brain realizes the public despair is his ticket to omnipotence. I am dazzled by an epiphany. The eye of Newt is upon the presidency. What else would be his grail? His entire political course has been a Mein Kampf toward his greater future as American Führer. I suddenly realize Newt is not the advocate for Congress he pretends to be. Congress is his power lift to the presidency. Newt must be president to force his contract upon America. He has to saddle the whirlwind he whipped up or lose the momentum he created. The so-called Republican Revolution he orchestrates is a deceptive restaging of Gilded Age hog feeding he manipulates for residency in the White House. Newt echoes convicted Wall Street junk bond king Ivan Bosky, aka Gordon Gekko. Greed is good, he says. Newt is a populist demagogue pundits and doom and gloomers are always warning about, an obsessively ambitious and clever imposter who operates on the fringe of fear and loathing. He exploits the disruption and apprehension usually apparent at fin di siècle, but the finale of the 20th century is opening curtain for a whole new millennium, which can't help but shriek like Banquo's witches of old hysterias and superstitions. Gingrich Kahn emerges from the shadowed plateau of our dread. Newt made his bones as the Republicans' chief political assassin in Congress. He scorns even an appearance of benevolence and wears his black hat proudly. I am an American Gaullist, he says. De Gaulle restored France. His faith was in nationalism and technology. But De Gaulle was a royalist who thought only he could save France, and he also believed its worst enemies were some of its citizens. Newt's eyes lock into mine in the bar mirror. He looks like somebody who won't be a friend. His eyes flicker away almost instantly. I feel dismissed as being of no use to his ambition. He probably guesses I am an old hippie, a tiny cell of the social cancer he wishes to wipe away like scum off a glass slide. I have worked for bosses like him. You don't exist to them except when useful or perceived a threat. Relate to me, I snarl at Newt in the mirror. Tell me about the malignancy within. Say it loudly. True Americans must eradicate untrue Americans. Tell me that society has to be ethnically cleansed of persons you call abnormal Americans, who are presumably people, like me, who are to the left of Attila the Hun, uppity pushy women, like First Lady Hillary Clinton, who frighten the testicles off white males, non-Christians, and aliens, who are everyone of color, no matter how many centuries their ancestors have lived here, even those who greeted Columbus and assisted Lewis and Clark. Convince me I owe my life and labor to a plutocracy that enriches itself by impoverishing the rest of us, I shout silently at Newt's mirror face. Inspire me that a great America depends on removing, quote, inferiors and undesirables who must be given the chance to die of their own weakness, unquote, by abolishing every opportunity for life, liberty, and their pursuit of happiness. I think of something a woman suggested. Hey, Newt, I smirk at his warping reflection. What if in vitro testing not only determined a person's sex, but also its sexual preference? Would your pro-life homophobic friends propose abortion for gay fetuses? Newt's reflected mouth moves as relentlessly as a drum-beating rabbit in a battery commercial. Our goal is simple, Newt says, to train 200,000 citizens as a model for replacing the welfare state and reforming government. I get the chills and gasp at his audacity. Newt is proposing to raise a private army election year, a rabble of true believers recruited to make domestic politics as severe and confrontational as the Cold War with communist Russia. No mercy for the other side or anyone else who resists the new kingfish, Huey Long incarnate. Politics and war are remarkably similar systems, Newt says, almost reading my mind. We are a happy band of Vikings who don't mind a fight. Newt's brand of Americanism makes me think of an old cartoon poster of Nixon and Agnew, who are unshaved cooks in a gag and barf cafe. Nixon shoves a plate of red, white, and blue spaghetti with star-spangled meatballs at the observer. Shut up and eat it, he snarls. I wonder if Newt's loyal core, whom he charismatically intimidates into obeisant mesmerism, realize that their narrow and flogging perception of democracy disrupts the majority they claim to represent. That has always been the problem of majority rule. A majority is easily bullied to bully. Laceration of deep inferiority feelings works almost every time. People react with fear and loathing, usually against minorities. The irony is that it is usually minorities who strive for liberty and justice, just as it is a minority that craves raw power and will do anything to get and keep it. Bodo, the bartender, refills my Red Death, which is what I call red wines of any aesthetic. Waste of time listening to those fatheads, he says. Maybe being a liberal isn't so popular nowadays, Bodo says, but at least we've got larger alimentary canals than rednecks and don't keep all that bile bottled up. Newt explains capitalism to his eagerly capitalistic cronies. The capitalist system gives every American the opportunity to move up and achieve, he says. We should look at it that everybody has an opportunity to achieve, but not necessarily accomplish equal results. Some become more equal than others by accumulating more than equal property, wealth, and power, which, of course, shrinks the equality of the rest. Newt thinks that's the way it should be. Natural selection, social Darwinism is a fact, he says. He follows this disingenuous alliteration to Adam Smith with a gem of doublethink. The engine that pulls the train must continue to be fueled, he says. He spells it out. Tax breaks for low-income people must be sacrificed for high-income relief. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt says. I sneer at Newt's bald-faced image in the mirror. Those affluent taxpayers don't invest in anything except their own portfolios, and they not only don't pay their fair share of taxes, they gorge on public money, which people like Newt call welfare when distributed among the poor and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time congressional Republicans cut off welfare to unwed teenage mothers and downsized workers, they inflate special tax cuts to favored corporations that amount to beaucoup billions and billions of bucks. They cut the taxes and absolve tax-dodging penalties of big business and wealthy elites and spoil them with billions more in subsidies and entitlements they claim are essential to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force, like sex and babies. Public service and poverty programs are gutted to make up the shortfall. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. That is Republican financial policy and the taproot of its counterfeit revolution, Newt's crown jewel. Maybe Newt and his gang should be allowed to rule without protest or resistance in the interests of the nation's neo-Tories and roll back the hard-won laws and principles of nearly 2.5 centuries. Ordinary people might realize what they have to lose and take back what they've lost, which should sober up the next couple of generations. But maybe no one will be inclined to retrieve rights our forebears knew were essential to liberty, justice, and equality. And maybe democracy didn't win the Cold War after all. Old, coarse fascism in modern populist disguise has triumphed. Hothouse capitalism exists best in strictly controlled environments in which social classes are rigidly defined and no one is allowed to question or reform the arthritic incompetence and desolation such corrupt and moribund plutonomies usually foster and perpetuate like fetid molds. You try to confuse us, I say, to mirror Newt. You claim that corporate capitalism is free market Americanism when you really know corporatism is inherently socialistic. You try to convince us that big business enthusiastically competes for sheer love of competition and unfettered commerce when it's really winner take all. I laugh harshly at Newt's facile face and drink a long swallow of Red Death. One of the regular sops slops against me at the bar. He looks over at Newt. I know that guy, he says. Oliver Cromwell, I say. No, that guy, that TV guy, Donahue. Newt gets spacey as the drinks flow. He touts a virtual world, simulated, distracted from the real world. Instead of cake, as suggested by Marie Antoinette, Newt wants the common folk to feed on sugar frosting. We can develop populism in space and the beginning of citizen involvement by initiating a tourism program for the American people, he says, and blames the welfare state for, quote, the decision to not move more quickly into space, unquote. If you think about the notion that the great challenge of our lifetimes is to first imagine a future that is worth spending our lives getting to, Newt says, and then, because of the technologies and capabilities we have today, to get it up to sort of a virtual state, although that's done in your mind, what did he say? I find it fascinating that we are not in a new place, Newt says. It's just becoming harder and harder to avoid the place where we are. Newt is lost in space babble. He rants about factories and jobs in space, a honeymoon on the moon, and a host of high-tech efforts to spread a new electronic gospel. Moonbeamy, technocolic. Newt is future drunk. Technomania in eternal universal conflict with technophobia. He foresees intense rivalry in the very near future as a result of overpopulation and depleted resources as his grand opportunity. He is staking out the pennant of the rich and famous as his very own mainspring to absolute universal power. You're making sure your rich patrons get through the millennium by sacrificing the rest of us. All for yourselves and nothing for anybody else, I mumble aloud to Newt's blurred virtual face in the mirror. You and your gang are stripping away everything that counts, even clean air, clear water, and the last forests. You're giving everything back to the big polluters and the rape and pillagers, and make it patently impossible for preventive legislation or lawsuits for public or personal damages. You say you're a futurist, but you act as crazy as Reagan's Interior Secretary Watt, a Nazi SS Himmler lookalike, who said environmentalism was unnecessary because, quote, God was going to terminate Earth any minute. A crowd comes in and quickly fills the top of the Astor. Rush Limbaugh sits at a table with Pat Robertson and Robert Dole. Ralph Reed and his Christian coalition bunch together a few tables. Pat Buchanan sits by himself as usual. Tattooed skinheads in cut-off leathers, chains, and swastika emblems maraud in at the bar. A large group of beer-gut commandos in military camouflage, armed with NRA-approved assault rifles, marches in. Mark Hemphill, an insultingly rich motel king who nearly single-handedly bought last year's legislature, surrounds Newt with members of the Oregon Business Roundtable. Newt raises his glass in salute. Money is the mother's milk of politics, the Speaker of the House says cheerfully. Clarno, Durfler, and Tiernan lick Newt's glossy shoes while he sings, the morning will come when the world will be mine. Tomorrow belongs to me. I recognize it from the musical Cabaret, an angelic blonde Nazi boy singing in a beer garden. Rita squirms through the crowd to Newt's table. She bends to pick up empty glasses and full ashtrays. Tiernan laughs and pinches her fanny. She smacks the tray against his head, which disappears in an explosion of ashes and shards of glass. I see it all in the mirror and rush over to the table, prepared to say everything in my mind. I splash my last glass of red death in Newt's face like Jose Ferrar did to Fred McMurray in Caine Mutiny. You slimy reptile, I shout. The Republican majority of the Oregon legislature appear from everywhere in the restaurant and bar. I am engulfed. Hands grasp me, lift me off the floor, and throw me out an open window next to Newt's table. As I fall 8 floors from the top of the Astor to the street, I see anchored oil tankers staining a toxinated river empty of salmon and sea lions. The city's bumpy scalp skinned of trees, smoke pumping into the ozone and sewage into the river from fully computerized paper mills and aluminum plants wall to wall on the waterfront. Vacant, shabby, or burnt shells of old houses falling down the hills. Downtown is desolate, boarded up. Out of work, Astorians fight each other for scarce food stamps, stand on street corners with begging cups, or squat along curbs, smoking dope, shooting smack, and drinking rot-gut wine or whiskey. Wolf packs of homeless children roam through the city. Newt's America. I hit the sidewalk and wake up. And that was Newt's Here, which I wrote. Newt Gingrich was forced to resign as House Speaker in 1999 for ethics violations involving use of public money for his own aggrandizement and lying about it to the Congressional Ethics Committee. Perhaps Newt's personal venture into space might be more like Star Trek's Gene Roddenberry and LSD guru Timothy Leary, simply ashes scattered among the cosmos. This has been Michael McCusker, and happy birthday to my grand little 1-year-old nephew this coming Sunday.